It's time for Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking. And now, here's Tupelo Tom and Big Lou.
I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're talking.
Well, man, that was tight, dude.
Maybe on your end it was. I'm you know what? I've actually discovered that I actually physically operate on a time delay.
Oh, okay. There you
just
go. Perfect.
Just in life itself. How are you, Big Lou?
I am doing fantastic. Watched the solar eclipse. Got a fresh new view on the world and life now. I went down to Texas and had a great view of it. The clouds literally parted.
Wow.
Just for the eclipse, and it got dark, the birds got loud, then quiet, and then I drove home. That was about it.
That sounds like an exciting day. It's a nice way to spend a Monday. Alex, our producer, Alex Mitchell, good morning, good afternoon. Hello.
Hello there. Hey, how are you guys?
I'm good. I haven't seen both of you since Nashville. We'll talk about Nashville, the Nashville Elvis Festival, in a few minutes, but I just wanted to see what's anybody been up to besides eclipse chasing. I just went out in the backyard, and I was kind of like Chevy Chase in that scene from Vacation at the Grand Canyon. I walked out, looked at it, went, okay, and came back in because it was just kind of like a cloudy day in Tupelo, and the sun came back out when it was over, and then it got darker. It actually got darker when the rain started at 3 o'clock than it was for the eclipse itself at like 1:50. So it was kind of strange.
The cool thing was the temperature drop.
Yeah.
So fast, then right back up. So it was a neat experience.
Yeah. The anticipation for this, on radio, when you host a radio show, anything like the eclipse is gold. Because it gives you weeks of material. The prep services send you weeks of material of stuff about, you know, trivia about eclipses and things. So I always love to talk about things like that because, you know, award shows, any kind of iconic thing happening, you get to talk about it for a week or two leading up to it. And that's good for a couple of segments. So by the time the actual event itself gets here, you're kind of over it. So that eclipse thing, I was like, I'll be really glad to talk about something else.
Yes.
Cause for a while it was Taylor Swift and Travis, you know, I was like, oh, guess what? And then every month or two, there's something that comes along that becomes the thing. And so the eclipse, I hope I'm not on the air in 20 years when the next one happens. Who knows? I hope I actually can understand what an eclipse is in 20 years, whatever, you know, when that happens. But the other night I was having, I got some emails from some people, messages that, my old home, Turner Classic Movies, is celebrating, their 30th anniversary in the month of April. They launched in April of 93, and, they've had all these, former employees of TCM on the air with Ben and the hosts talking about, what things were like at Turner back in the 90s and the 2000s. And I've heard my name mentioned a couple of times. So I thought that was kind of nice that they talked about some of the things we were doing on TCM.
Wow. Like, oh, great.
I was part of the committee of three people that hired Ben Mankiewicz. So Ben's very grateful to me.
I bet.
So, yeah. So it's been fun, and it's been fun to they get to pick a movie to host. And I messaged a couple of friends of mine there, and I said, well, I guess you guys didn't invite me. I guess you didn't need anyone to host Smokey and the Bandit.
Because right.
They pretty much know what my movie would have been anyway. So, but I did that, and I took a trip the other day, a couple week or so ago, to Memphis. I was invited to an event that happened on Beale Street. And it's very cool what they've done. Now, you guys all know the old Hard Rock building, right?
Yes.
Where the Hard Rock was. That was also formerly the Elvis Presley's Memphis restaurant there on Beale Street. And it was also the original home. Anybody know? Anybody
know? The Jeff Lewis and Friends after parties, but actually Lansky's.
Lansky's, that's right. And It's fun to find out what's happened because the Lansky's have sold that building, and it will now be the new home of the Memphis Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Memphis Musicians Hall of Fame, the Rock and Soul Museum, and the Mike Curb Music School of Excellence. It is going to
Wow.
be a new museum complex, of which Priscilla Presley was there to kick off the event. And I'm looking for the news release.
While you're doing that, you know, Tom, as you know, we spent several incredible years both at the old Hard Rock, which is down the street from there, and then into the new Hard Rock, and had all those exciting after parties with so many stories. I was going, kind of went down a YouTube rabbit hole, and I was seeing videos I didn't even know existed from those after parties. Huh. And two real interesting ones I saw that I forgot about, but was one of them was the first time an 8-year-old Finley Watkins took the stage with all of us and played piano and played Jerry Lee. And he was this little bitty chubby kid. Now he's about this 6'3" young man. And then, but it was from that show that the Ellen DeGeneres Show reached out to us and asked us who the little kid was, if we knew how to reach him. And then he ended up being on that show. The other cool thing I totally forgot about is we're on stage, and all of a sudden this good looking guy gets on stage with me and Jacob Roman. And I think EAS was backing us at the time. And we're just having a big time. A young man who everybody kind of knows now because of America's Got Talent, Drake Milligan.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that was neat. A lot of great memories there, and a lot of fun. But I remember Lansky's had a little shop in there, and mm-hmm. they'd been talking about it being a Memphis Music Hall of Fame. And then, of course, COVID hit and everything. It just got empty and went down from there. So I'm so glad to see such a cool building with such an important history to me personally, not to mention Memphis and Elvis fans.
It was tough for Hal and the family to let go of that, but it to be now something that'll be utilized, and we'll have music playing in it. The stage will stay where the stage was.
Awesome.
Because that's going to be the part of the Mike Curb Music Initiative.
That is so cool.
There's going to be people, you know, young people will be educated in music there. The Rock and Soul Museum, the Memphis Music Hall of Fame will be there at 126 Beale Street. So now right there at the head of Beale Street, Mr. B, Bernard Lansky and the Lansky family will have a forever part of Beale Street history again. I mean, they've been there since 46 when they opened, but and I can tell you how much of an important event it was. Hal Lansky was speaking at the event as well, but it was important enough to Hal to have his employees there, because when I went into the Peabody before the event to see Hal, as I walked out with him, he put a sign up on the door that Lansky's was going to be closed for an hour for the event on Beale Street.
Wow.
For Hal to close during business hours is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. You know Hal is such a great guy. I remember the first time I met him, we were at the Hard Rock kind of setting up, and I introduced myself, and he said, "So you're a singer, huh?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "Well, we'll see about that." And sure enough, he came over that night. And I got off stage. He said, "Man, you really are a singer." And he, from that point on, we stayed in contact. He always recognized, we always talked. And I remember one time I went into Lansky's a couple of years ago, and he had ordered I'm not the smallest guy in the world, so he had ordered a jacket in a size bigger than normal just for me. So I went to buy a couple other things. He had one of the best lines. He goes, "Well, you know, Jeff, it's your lucky day." He said, "This is unlimited day. You can buy as much as you want." But I'm proud to say, and I won't get into the numbers because I want to wait till Elvis week, see where I'm at, but I've lost a substantial amount of weight. And one of my goals when I reach my goal weight, it should be around Elvis week, is to walk into Lansky's and be able to comfortably buy several things off the rack. That's not normal for a man of size.
Yeah, other than the sock rack for
that's
me.
That's right.
The
guitar rack.
Yeah, the day, it was a cool day, so I decided to wear my Lansky leather jacket, my TCB leather jacket.
That's awesome.
And when I saw Hal, I had come in from outside and went to Lansky's and saw Hal, and he said, "Pop that collar. You pop that collar up." And he walked around behind me and popped my collar up, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
And I said, Hal, I don't know if I'm a popped up collar kind of guy. And he goes, "You're wearing a leather jacket." You're bold enough to do that. You're bold enough to pop the collar. He said, people travel from all over the world to have me pop their collar. So pop that collar. So I'm like, all right, collar popped. And I got to say hello to Priscilla and spend a few minutes with her. And it was great to see her there for the event. She came into Memphis. And it was Aunt Jerry Phillips was there, Sam Phillips' son. Just great to see a lot of people. Rodney Polk, who's got the Rockin' 88s band, was there. My buddy, the drummer, Bill Street Band. If you get a chance to see the Rockin' 88s, they're fantastic. They do all that great rockabilly stuff. And it was just kind of fun to hang out on Beale Street and see this event and to know that the history of Memphis music is going to be right there on Beale Street. I'm very excited for Hal. And the next time you guys go by, it'll be kind of opening in stages. They're kind of in a fundraising mode right now. So we'll try to share that link where people could go to donate some money for that. And something else they might want to donate for. I was at an event just the other night. I was invited by Norbert Putnam to host a little evening with Norbert in Florence, Alabama, his hometown, where the University of North Alabama has established a new Norbert Putnam Music Industry Scholarship for music students there at University of North Alabama in Florence. And this was kind of the kickoff celebration of there being a Norbert Putnam scholarship. And I told the story about when Norbert called me about that he was getting a scholarship for University of North Alabama. I thought, wow, Norbert is still curious enough at his age that he wants to go back to college. And I didn't realize, this is for a young person scholarship, not for you. Okay, that makes more sense. And we had a great evening. A lot of the hoi polloi of Florence were there, a lot of people. But here's the kind of the Elvis magic stuff, okay? So the event is over, and Norbert says, we'll meet you back. There's a hotel there, the Marriott Spa in Florence, and they've got this 360 bar that's this – it looks like the tower thing in Seattle, you know, that little – the restaurant on top that rotates mm-hmm. around, that thing, yeah. The Space Needle. It looks
– Space Needle,
but it's the Alabama version. You know, it's smaller. and I walk in, and sitting at the bar there in Florence, Alabama, at the 360 – I walk in. It's a guy I graduated high school with from Tupelo that's lived in Florence for 35 years. He's a doctor, Ed Moore. And I said, hey, you know the song Margaritaville? And he goes, yeah. I go, yeah, this guy produced it right here. This guy right here.
That's great. You know, it's just Tom,
weird.
I've received so much feedback on the Putt interview. I call him Putt now. I didn't know if you'd heard.
That's true.
And I've had more positive people loved that podcast. My buddy Chuck down at the Cigar Bar, all he could talk about was how cool it was and the stories Putt told and how interesting he was. And I've just had so much come. That was just a great episode. I'm so thankful Norbert did that for us.
It was and imagine an evening of him an hour there in front of an audience and he and his wife, Cheryl, asked me to host. She said, because it's not like anybody needs to ask Putt a question. That's really not what's involved. It's keeping him on. It's basically time cues.
Yeah.
You know, that's he starts talking and I just look at my watch and go, okay, in an hour, I'm going to say something. And the amazing thing about it was that he was able to have this great time. And at the conclusion of the event, he played his bass along to the recording of Bridge Over Troubled Water. He told the story about recording Bridge. And the funny thing about the song is he doesn't play for like a minute, 25 seconds or something.
Right.
And then he comes in and he did the live bass accompaniment to the recording of Elvis.
Oh,
and that's
cool.
How we conclude. I told Putt, I said, you know, Norbert, if we can just get to the bridge part, this will be a killer ending. Everything else we do doesn't matter. It's always about the ending. So yeah. that was a lot of fun. So we did that. So between Beale Street and Norbert Putnam in Florence, Alabama and TCM's anniversary, I've had a great month. Alex, I know you guys, we had a great time in Nashville. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Nashville later on in the show. But let's take a quick break because we've got coming on to the Tupelo Tom and Big Lou podcast, we've got my buddy Roy Turner over down the street from me right now, just a few miles away at the Elvis Presley birthplace. And I want to find out and talk about what's going on there. He's got a lot of cool stuff happening at that little house on the hill in Tupelo. So Big Lou, let's take a break and we'll be back right after this. We'll be back to talking.
Hi. You know why Quaker State asked me to be their spokesman? Because I'm tough. Quaker State is tough. Tough on wear and tough on sludge. If you use Quaker State in your new car's engine, they'll guarantee it for 250,000 miles or 10 years in writing. Quaker State is one tough motor oil. So naturally, they ask me because I'm tough. You don't think it's because they think I'm oily?
Hey, Roy, how you doing?
Hey, Roy.
Good. How are you guys?
Good.
Good. Good to see you.
You too.
Thank you for doing this. I'm glad we got to get you before the big trip tomorrow.
Yeah.
Are you a podcast listener when you travel like that on a long trip?
I have not. I'll have to do that.
You'll have to go back and check out some of our episodes. The last episode we did was we had about an hour or more interview with Norbert Putnam talking about his career in music and stuff. So there's a lot of cool stuff. And then Dateline NBC has got so many great murder podcasts that there was some town last year, I think it might have been Waco, that it took 10 hours to get there. And I was so enthralled in this podcast, I got to the hotel after 10 hours and I drove around for 5 minutes because I didn't want to
finish.
I wanted to finish the podcast. So
I listen to one sometimes, Mobituaries.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I like
Moraka.
Him.
Moraka.
Yes. I like him.
Yeah. Those are good. All right, Alex, are you cool?
Yeah, we're good. I'm excited.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll bring us back from break and we'll go right into Roy. And let's see, it's 2:52 now, so we'll have you out of here in a decent amount of time.
I'm here till 5. Even if there's nobody here.
That was always a problem when I worked at the movie theater at the Malco and the Lyric. There would be times on a Sunday afternoon if I had especially at the Malco because it was a twin cinema. Mm-hmm. You'd have a big movie at the big house and a nothing movie at the little house, and 2:15 the movie started. Well, if there was nobody in the house, do you start the movie or not? Because here's the thing. If you don't start it and somebody comes 10-15 minutes late, now you got to start it. Now you're 10-15 minutes late getting out of there. So I always, my boss came in one time and the movie was running. He goes, there's nobody in there. Why'd you start the movie? And I said, because I didn't know nobody was going to show up. I have to start it as if somebody walks in and says, I figured there'd be trailers and then we'll see the movie. So they didn't. So you never know when the last person is.
That's right. Was that Mr. Schrecker?
That was William Schrecker. Yes. He hired me at 16 years old. That crazy man.
He hired me at 14. But my great aunt worked there in the ticket booth, and she said, "Now he won't hire you until you're 15, so tell him you're 15. I said, "But that's a lie." She said, "I've been lying about my age all my life. Tell him you're 15.
I didn't know we had that in common. That's pretty cool.
I worked concessions.
Yeah. I was a relief projectionist and house manager. I would go to.
Do you remember his name? Might have been Doc, but
yes,
he had one arm.
Yes, I remember Doc. He had one hand.
He said, "Boy, come up here." He heard I was a Marilyn Monroe fan. He had the 1948 Miss Golden Dreams calendar hanging up there, and he gave it to me.
Wow.
Well, my mama always made me keep it hid. And the first year me and Debbie was married, they got the bright idea to have a yard sale and they sold my calendar.
My God.
Probably for $2. So every year or two, I'd say Maryland sold for $2,000. Maryland sold for, when it got up to about $25,000, I just quit telling them.
Yeah, that's, wow. Roy Turner, Executive Director for the Elvis Presley Birthplace. Welcome to the podcast, Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking. It's great talking with you.
Good to be here.
And I see Roy every month or so when we have board meetings because I got to join the board at the birthplace, and it's been a wonderful experience. And Roy, you guys have just the things that have been happening just in the last couple of years since COVID hit, it kind of almost gave you guys an opportunity to reset and to think about what you wanted to do, because life at the birthplace is nonstop. You really don't have time to reflect very much.
We've been fortunate that our board has let us pursue the things we want to pursue, both in updating how things look, We've developed a whole new line of products that are birthplace specific that have been very popular. Just planted a lot more gardens down around the lake to make it a more enjoyable visit. We got a stone wall behind Lisa Marie and Elvis's benches and got that landscaped. It looks fabulous. And we're busy.
Yeah.
We've got 29 buses booked for this month. Friday, we've got 5 in one day, and the next Friday, 6 in one day. I think we've got 173 booked so far for the year, and it's only April. But our real traffic is the foot traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And last week, all the people go into the eclipse stopped in and gave us a wonderful week. We had traffic like a stirred up ambient. It felt so good because we'd had a rather dead January and February.
Yeah. It's fascinating because when I was a kid growing up in that neighborhood over on Morningside Drive, there were always cars from all over the United States, even back in the 60s and 70s when Elvis was alive. I mean, it was that the birthplace really has been there for a number of years. But in looking at the history, a lot of people might not understand kind of how it started. Can you give the history? I know didn't the Garden Club, weren't they the first to really take care of that area?
Well, as probably everybody knows, when Elvis came back in 56 to do his homecoming concert, when it was over, he gave the check back to the mayor and said, I noticed the house I was born in 13 acres for sale. I want you to take this money, buy it, and build a park for the kids in East Tupelo. This was the so-called poor side of town, wrong side of the tracks. I was one of those kids. We didn't know we were poor. We just knew we weren't rich. He came back the next year, did another concert, and gave that money to build a youth center, which is now our ticket area and museum. I had my first dance in ninth grade in what's now our museum. I think it says a lot about the man he was at 21 to be thinking of others, because I have to be honest, at 21, I was pretty self-centered. But that's the kind of guy he was. So the house sat basically abandoned for several years, and it was really falling in disrepair. And the East Tupelo Garden Club asked the city if they could take it on as a project, and they raised money, I think, first to put a decent roof on it. Then they solicited the community to donate furniture from the era. And I remember going as a kid, and there was a fruit jar sitting on the sewing machine with a note, donations welcome. And you dropped a penny, nickel, dime, dollar, whatever you could in to go through the little house. But if it had not been for their foresight, I'm afraid we would have lost it.
Yeah. And there's a painting inside the museum that I think shows something that a lot of people don't understand, which is that house, that birthplace, was one of a number of those kind of homes in a row. I mean, the hillside there, this was littered with those little those two room shacks.
There were houses all the way down to Main Street, both two and four room. Mm-hmm. It was a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And Leek and Goodlett, a longtime lumber company that's not in business anymore, told me most likely Vernon bought the house as a kit from them because they were selling those kits. And if you go to South Tupelo in the Milltown area, you'll mm-hmm. see some in the lower economic regions because they were affordable. Also, the island in our parking lot, that north side was a dead-end street that had houses on it. Mm-hmm. So it was much more crowded than it is now. We've been able to acquire, we started with 13 acres. We're up to 15 and I'd like to buy some more just to protect our area.
Yeah. It's interesting having been a kid growing up in that neighborhood and growing up in Tupelo in the 60s and 70s when Elvis was alive. I mean, you're a few years older than me, but I'm sure you can remember those times that through the city, the rumor would swirl if anyone with dark hair was seen in a Cadillac, Elvis is in town. I mean, there were, and a lot of times it was true. He wasn't. He was in town.
We usually were aware of it the day after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was in third grade, someone came to my class and knocked on the door and said, Elvis is visiting Mrs. Grimes, his fifth grade teacher. Our teacher said, boys and girls, be quiet. And she left. And of course, we went ballistic. We just knew he was going to go to that stage at Lawhorn School where he first sang Old Shep and get us out of math and sing a song or two. But that sucker stood us up. And we were not Elvis fans that day. And then when I was 11, pretty much around 11, me and my buddies, we played at Tulip Creek, which is where he also played. And it was a little narrow wooden bridge and a narrow gravel road. And we were leaving one day on our bikes, and we had to pull over for this black car that you weren't accustomed to seeing in that neck of the woods pass by. And as it did, the window was down, and one of us goes, "Huh, that looked like Elvis." And we just kept pedaling because we were 11. We had more important things to do. But I feel sure it was, in fact, Elvis, because I learned how later, you know, he would bring people back and show them where he swam, where he went to school, got his guitar, where he was born, et cetera, et cetera.
And go to Janelle's house a lot, too.
Go to her house as well. And he would visit Guy. You know, Guy told me in the early days of his career, this would be in the 50s, but it was after, you know, Love Me Tender and Loving You, where he had a good bit of fame. He said he would come in from school and Elvis would be there sitting, visiting with his mother. Of course, Guy's mother and Gladys had been best friends. He said he came in from school one day and they were both sitting at the kitchen table and had obviously eaten a sandwich and just fell asleep.
Wow.
But, you know, Tupelo.
And, the guy you're talking about is Guy Harris, who
Guy
they were
Harris,
they
his
kind of
childhood friend.
Yeah, they hung
great
and,
guy
you know,
too.
He came back and visited Guy other times as an adult. The last time I think was 71. Mm-hmm. But Guy also told me that he would get a call. He said maybe 3-4 times back in the 60s, he'd get a call and say, "Guy, it's Elvis." He always had to tell him who he was. "Can you meet me on the hill?" Meaning the hill at the back of the property. And he said Elvis would just be dressed in regular clothes. They'd stand there, look down at the swimming pool, the ball field, tennis court, playground equipment, and the kids. And Elvis would say, "Are the kids using it? Is it a good thing? Did I do a good thing?" So he didn't just donate and forget. He kept a handle on it. And I've had other stories where he kept a handle on Tupelo. I did a little interview with Carth Radio Station a couple of years ago, and one of the guys there who happened to be Buddy Bain's nephew, and Buddy Bain was a local celebrity of sorts, and he said he worked there from 62 to 68, I believe he said. He said, "You know, every year you guys had a telethon." I said, "Yeah, we still do for the regional rehab." He said, "Every year we would get a donation just before it ended to put us over our goal. We knew it was Elvis, but we were sworn to secrecy. So while he was out in Hollywood making those movies that he was really bored with, he still had his eye on the home place."
Wow.
Tupelo was very special to Elvis. There's no doubt in my mind about it. But think about it. He's 2 months shy of his 14th birthday. All of his childhood memories are here. Memphis holds his teenage memories and all.
It's interesting too, because I think what the birthplace has done, and that would be Henry Dodge, the longtime head of the board, and Dick Guyton, the gentleman who had the job before you, the guidance that they gave and the feel that they gave that you continue on now is really to differentiate the boy and the young man who went to Memphis. And there's a feeling that people get, and I hear it all the time from international travelers that I see it at festivals and that have come to Tupelo, and not only the birthplace, but the city itself, there's just a feeling there that is so different than Memphis. And you really get it at the birthplace of how this is about the boy.
The boy.
You really have that intimate feeling about a real place. And I think the birthplace is a physical representation. I don't think until people walk in that door and see it that they understand how poor really is, or really was for Elvis.
Well, our mission is to tell the story of Elvis the boy, and we leave the entertainment side to Graceland.
Yeah.
Ramona, who works in the church, doing the church program some days, and Ramona's real over the top, talks very loud. She reminds me a lot of Dolly Parton. This author was here with her mother, actually writing a book, and I think it's called A Trip to Graceland or something like that. And she wound up putting Ramona in the book because Ramona was telling about things, you know. And then after the program, Ramona sits down chatting with them, says, "Well, where are you going next?" And they say Graceland. And the mother says, "You know, that's where Elvis, you really get to know Elvis at Graceland." And Ramona's response, and I love it, was, "Just remember, Elvis built Graceland, but Tupelo built Elvis."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very true. I mean, he had it in his DNA.
Yeah.
You know,
It's, I've had, you know, some of the guys tell me that were with Elvis, you know, no one could wear denim. No one could wear blue jeans because he said he wore enough of that in his life that he never even wanted to be around it anymore. So, you know, also, too, there's a part of the inside of the museum. I mean, a lot of great items there in the museum. But I love what you've done in the hallway that goes down to the theater with the display cabinets. And you guys, and Alex was actually a part of the ribbon cutting. I think he had the big scissors, if I'm not mistaken.
You were, weren't you?
I was. Yeah.
Yeah. The items that we had were items Janelle had collected primarily as a fan, except for a few special things from Elvis.
And Roy, tell everybody who Janelle was, Janelle McComb.
Janelle McComb was a friend of Elvis's who lived here. And she was very instrumental upon his death in helping to keep this place going when it operated in the red, actually. And I have to be frank, the city of Tupelo, to my recollection, I've been here 71 years, they were not proud of Elvis. They didn't celebrate Elvis. They did not realize what a jewel they had in Elvis until after his death. And actually it took a few years, you know, for the city to catch on, to realize that this man has touched lives all over the world and continues to all these years after his death. There aren't many people that can make that claim. He had something special. It's not just his music, his life story, especially the childhood and becoming this great American singer and icon, is an inspiration to so many people. They tell me that on a daily basis, so it's got to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But Janelle had this collection out there that was mostly fan things. And John Daly, who has the EP pawn shop in Memphis, he would show me things he had. And I just made a comment, John, I wish there was some way we could just have one of these galleries with some of this stuff in it. And he said, I got enough to fill all the gallery. So he did, with original merchandise from 56 and 57. It is so unique. And folks, since we put that in, people actually stop. They used to walk up the hall, you know, at a passing glance and maybe stop at one particular thing. People stop and they take in every single window. It has been a super addition to the Elvis experience here.
I think what's so interesting about it, especially after the Baz Luhrmann movie, is you really understand about Colonel Parker and marketing, and to see the real items that were recreated for the movie, but to see the real items from the 50s that Colonel was a part of, the I love Elvis, I hate Elvis buttons, that kind of thing.
And did you notice one even says Elvis was a joik?
Yeah,
I've never even heard the term joik.
Yeah, well, you hadn't been to the Bronx.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, it's interesting because I love that the film that we because I'm on the board now. The film that's shown every day tells that great story of Elvis. Back in the gosh, it was 78, 79, 80. I was at the dedication. I was at the groundbreaking and the dedication of the chapel, the meditation chapel, and then a few years back, tell this. I just think this is a fascinating story. The story of the church, which is now on property. But tell everybody the story of the church, because Roy, here's the thing: there's so many new fans that are coming into this Elvis world. Mm-hmm. No story is too old or too shopworn, because there are new fans learning stuff all the time. And so this item of Elvis, just such, you know, we know how important the church was to Elvis and the music of the church, and it's there now.
We are so fortunate, and we have Guy Harris to thank for that, because he brought it to our attention, because it had been converted to a house. And when it became available for sale, Guy went to the board and said, you know, that was Elvis's childhood church, because I went and visited with him several times at that church. You guys ought to buy it and bring it up there and restore it, which we did. It's and in the story we tell, it's where Elvis first heard the gospel. It's where he first sang the gospel. It's also where he learned O Ship, because Brother Frank Smith told me that on Sunday nights, he would bring the kids down to teach them songs. Sometimes it was a hymn. Sometimes it was a popular song. And he said this one Sunday night, this guy on the Grand Ole Opry, he referred to as the Singing High Sheriff, who I've never been able to track anything down on him, came out with Old Shep. I'd always heard it was a Red Foley song, and I think he did do it as well. And he said he taught it to all the kids, but Elvis just took it and made it his. Now, an interesting thing about the church, originally it was on Adams Street, and they outgrew it and had to build a new building, so they moved it to a vacant lot on Berry Street. And it just so happened that vacant lot on Berry Street was the lot where when Vernon gets out of Parchman and gets on his feet, he buys that the house that's set on that spot on Berry Street. Lives there for about a year, and then he sells it to Aaron Kennedy, his friend and elder in that little church, and also who Elvis Aaron was named after. Well, about 56, 57, that house burned, and that lot was vacant. So when they got ready to build the new church, they moved the old church to that old lot where Elvis had lived for a year as a kid. Oh. I think that's an interesting little side note.
It sure is. It's and the exhibit inside the church is one of those special things too, because it's almost like I don't want to give away too much because it's such a surprise for first time mm-hmm. visitors when the activity happens within the church. That's a wonderful.
And, you know, we Southerners have experienced that type of worship to one degree or another, if not in our own church. You know, I was raised Church of Christ. We wouldn't even have a piano, much less raise a hand. But I visited with friends. And then, of course, the Baptists were more lively in their music. But what I call high church, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Catholic, and all of the Europeans that come are blown away by that service because they've never seen anything like it. Mm-hmm. And you can, I carried Elaine Dundy, who did Elvis and Gladys. I wanted her to see what kind of worship Elvis experienced as a kid. So I asked Brother Frank Smith's wife, Corinne, where can we go to let her see what he experienced? She said, well, you can't do it in Tupelo. We've gotten too sophisticated. But they're having, this was late July of 81, they're having a little revival in the community of Judah in Pontotoc County. And it's like it was 50 years ago. So we go, it's hot, the windows are up, the ceiling fans are going. We left after 3 hours, and it was still going strong. We saw people dancing and fainting and talking in tongues and praising. And we come out, and Elaine Dundy, who was at that time from London, said, my God, I feel like I've been to an Elvis concert. You could see the influence in his movements.
Yeah.
And, of course, some of his voice inflections. And,
mm-hmm. I grew up in a Pentecostal church. I saw plenty of and sang it. And, you know, Roy, one of the coolest, of course, I love Tupelo. I call it my second home. You know, Charlie Watson and Debbie and all of them, I'm just, they're literally part of my family. And Tom and I, I've been all over the world performing, got to sing on the Ryman Grand Ole Opry. But one of the coolest experiences I had was Tom and I on one of Elvis's birthdays, maybe the 80th birthday celebration. We got to, Tom and I and a guy named Jody McDowell played piano. And Tom would do these interviews on the phone. In the theater there at the birthplace. And when you're an Elvis fanatic like me and you love Tupelo like me, and you're sitting there on the stage, and every now and then I would just stop and go, yeah, Elvis was born here, right here. I mean, it's how, you know, and what we would do is we'd take Tom would interview someone. Then I'd come up with a song that maybe fit that interview, and Jody and I would do it. And then we let some people ask questions. And there was a gentleman there who knew Elvis as a kid, and he was a kid about Elvis's age, and he had a bicycle.
Jackie Prather.
Okay. And Elvis had just got his guitar, and he wanted to trade that guitar for that bike, and he wouldn't do it, and Elvis got mad at him. And Jackie says, man, I'm glad I didn't make that trade.
Amen.
That was so great. And of course, Peggy Watson, Charlie Watson's wife is what I always call her. She gave me one of those hats from the 50s, mm-hmm. still even had the tag on it. And so that kind of merchandise that you can see at the birthplace, you're right. You see that and you go, oh my gosh, if I'd have been 12 to buy one of these or 13 to buy one of these, wasn't it a memory? It's a real tangible experience.
Yes.
What I love about guys, about the employees at the birthplace, is they all are so passionate about Elvis, the boy, and they remember and understand what it's like. I mean, and Roy, you can speak to this probably. People save a lifetime. Like right now, I'm planning a trip. I want to go to Europe and I want to go to Normandy. I want to go to the D-Day beaches. For people that are living and grew up in St. Mira-Glace, that's just the thing that's right down the road. It's no big there. You know, it's an impressive thing, but it's there. They've been 1,000 times. They don't think about it. For people, the locals in Tuba, that's the birthplace. You know, that's where you go. It's where you take visitors. You know, when they come to town, you take them to the birthplace.
If you want photographs made.
Yeah. But the employees there are every day meeting fans who have saved a lifetime. And you don't travel across the world to go to Graceland without going 90 miles to Tupelo also. I mean, you've already gone 7,000 miles from Australia. Why not go to – I mean, you're going to go to Tupelo. Just the amount of people you see on a daily basis, not from just all over the United States, but all over the world, just must blow you away every day, because every day is an adventure. You don't know what's going to happen.
It does blow me away. In fact – I started last summer. I don't know if you can see that. Probably not. That camera's not too good.
There you go. Yeah.
I started just saying, so where are you guys from? And they'd tell me. And I'd say, so how do you say thank you in your language? And they'd tell me. And I entered it in my phone phonetically.
That's great.
Which I have committed to memory. And now when I say, where are you from? In fact, this morning, this couple said they're from Norway. And I said, oh, let me see if I can get it right. My mind just went blank. And I know that's the one I know the best. Uncle Ben. And she said, yes. I said, did I do it halfway decent justice? Perfect. And then we had a tour group from Germany here this morning. There just happened to be this guy, Helmuth. He brought the first tour bus here when I went to work. So he was my first tour bus experience. He wanted to see me and see how I was. So the gift shop was full, and I just said, is that your group? And he said, yeah. So I hollered, Willkommen! And they all just turned, you know. They love to hear just a word or two of their own language. And then if they start back, yak, 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 I go, Duckle Bell, that's all I know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great idea.
You got to learn that's all I know, too. It's fascinating because you do. You have all those experiences of the fans. Yes. And what I love that a lot of people don't think about, they interact. They come together. They form friendships. We've seen it at festivals and during Elvis Week at Graceland and Birthday, where fans from all over the world, they meet up. They stay in touch because of
it
Elvis.
It becomes like a family reunion when the next year and the following years when they gather again for Elvis Week or whatever they gather for.
Yeah. And you guys have done something special the last couple of years at Birthday. The one day that is to me the most important to come to Tupelo, to be in Tupelo for an Elvis event with Betty Harper. You guys have teamed up for something that's really special too.
She's on board to design us a special T-shirt every year that we will unveil on his birthday. And as you well know, next year is the 90th, and we're planning a super blowout for it. I've already got tours booked internationally to be here for the birthday next year.
Wow, that's going to be available. You know, I'm available to host that, Roy. If you need anyone,
you're hired.
I work for cupcakes. And also one of those buses that comes down almost every Friday is that Graceland tour bus with my buddy Rex, the driver, and no telling who's on the bus as the tour guide. But they watch videos of myself and Angie Marchese, the head of archives. They get prepped to come to Tupelo, and that bus gets to travel around town, and you get to stop and see some of the Elvis sites. And of course, a big part of that is the group from Memphis coming down on the Elvis bus.
And they also show the documentary that I helped do, Elvis Return to Tupelo, which has them prepped when they get here. And their tour guides really build this birthplace up.
Yeah.
From the heart. It's not just a job. They're fortunate that they have some passionate folks too.
Yeah.
And like you were saying with our employees, Shelby and the church grew up in this neighborhood. She used to play in that little house as a kid when she'd go visit the people that lived there. Vanessa at the front desk, her aunt, or rather her great aunt, was Becky Martin, who was very close to Elvis. We have her story on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite Becky story is right after "That's All Right, Mama," she hears a horn blow and goes to the door, and it's Elvis, and what's a new car for him? And he says, "Hey, Beck, you want to go get a burger?" She said, "Yeah, give me a minute." So they go get the burger, and she says, he gets up and kind of saunters over to the jukebox and slips a quarter in and punches "That's All Right, Mama." That's how he lets her know he's got the record. They get through eating, and he says, "Hey, Beck, can you cover lunch? I put my last quarter in the jukebox." So it was 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a couple months later, she hears the horn blow and goes to the door, and it's him. He says, "Hey, Beck, we'll go get a burger." And she said she was feeling a little cocky that day, and she said, "No, it cost me last time." But Becky was a huge cheerleader for Elvis until the day she died. She died an old maid, and I think she carried a torch for him until the day she died, because she had known him since grade school.
See, that's the part of Tupelo that is so wonderful is to, mm-hmm. and we're losing those connections, those first degree connections like Guy and Sam Bell. Tell everybody who Sam Bell was.
Sam was just a wonderful storyteller in sharing his story. Sam was African-American. And as most people know, the last probably 14 months Elvis was in Tupelo, he lived at 1010 North Green and was the only white kid in an African-American community. We're talking late 47, 48, segregation. Elvis ran and played with those boys just like any boys. He and Sam would spend the night at one another's house, eat at one another's house. Sam was raised by his grandparents, and he said his grandparents thought the world of Elvis because he would say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am to them when white people did not show that kind of respect to African Americans. When they would go to the Lyric to see movies, Elvis went in the front. Sam had to enter the side marked colored. When they got upstairs, Elvis hopped over and sat with him in the balcony, and Sam said, "Nobody ever bothered us." And he told so many stories about them growing up. One of my favorites I can't tell because unfortunately, in this day and age, it would be considered racist. And it wasn't meant in a racist remark. And Sam loved to tell it and laughed about it. It just shows the relationship that they had.
Yeah, the term cultural appropriation sometimes is used by people who want to explain things. And the part of Elvis that grew up among the African American community in Tupelo, it was cultural appreciation, not appropriation. He didn't see color.
No, he did not.
He and his family and Sam and his family equally had nothing. So there's no, "I'm better than you." There's you play together. And I think that really, I think Sam, if anything, Sam was a big influence on Baz, who visited Tupelo.
Oh, yes.
And those Tupelo years in the Elvis movie, the Baz Luhrmann movie, I think is a great tribute to Sam.
It is. I just hate he passed before he could see it.
I do, too. He was.
Sam actually was better off than Elvis because his grandfather owned a good bit of that property in that neighborhood and several rental homes. So, in fact, his family was much better off economically than the Presleys.
Yeah. And that's one thing, too, that Elvis was born at the birthplace, but you alluded to it with the 1010 North Green. The Presleys moved around a lot in Tupelo, as you would do if you can't pay the rent.
He was 2 months shy of his 14th birthday when he left. During those years, they lived in 14 different residences.
Wow.
Then when they get to Memphis, before he buys Audubon, is the 17th residence they live in Memphis.
Wow.
So they were very mobile, as were everybody of that economic means during that era.
Hey, Roy, I heard something the other day, and I wanted to wait and ask you to verify this. And if it's true, guys, I'm going to blow your mind. Okay, Ms. Grimes, the teacher. Okay, tell everybody who Ms. Grimes is.
Okay. Of course, she was his fifth grade teacher. She recognized this talent for singing, encouraged him, pushed for him to be in the talent show. But the very interesting thing is, you know, when Vernon forges, Vernon doesn't forge the check. I finally got that story straight. I was repeating what older people had told me.
And you're actually telling the story I was leading to, so I'm glad we're doing this. Perfect.
I was able, when we did Elvis Return to Tupelo, one of the research people on that documentary got Vernon's file from Parchman. And in it was a letter from Orville Bean asking who owned that little house and who Vernon had sold the hog to, asking the governor to consider pardoning him. He was a young man that made a mistake. He thought he'd learned his lesson. But in the letter, he says, I wrote this young man a check for a hog he sold me. His friends, one of whom happened to be Gladys's brother, Travis Smith, and the other was Luther Gable, paid him $15 to let them take the check. And then they went to the bank and got some blank checks, more than one, and copied the signature, you know, held it up mm-hmm. to a window. And that's how all that came about. So when Gladys couldn't pay Orville Bean the payments, they were kicked out when Elvis was roughly 3 years old. Mrs. Grimes was Orville Bean's daughter, and she saw this potential in Elvis and promoted him and was very nurturing to him. And, you know, when he would come back as a kid, I bet at least five times I heard where he'd gone and visited Mrs. Grimes.
Yeah. Hmm. So the guy that wrote the check that Vernon, you know, and his group
participated in writing the check on.
Yeah. His daughter was Elvis's fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Grimes. Yes. That's what I had never connected those dots together.
Elaine connected those dots in Elvis and Gladys back in 81. And she says something along the lines of how a latter generation was sanctifying what a previous generation had done, although Orville Bean had done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
But it's funny how things go around and come around. And obviously Mrs. Grimes knew that, and she never held it against that family. Mm. Her quote on the back wall here says something, I have to paraphrase it, but it's, there's something nice about everybody, but everything was nice about Elvis, or something mm-hmm. to that effect. Mm.
Well, for all the people listening to the podcast, Roy, you're pretty much there every day, almost every day.
Till five.
And I mean, you've done such a great job since taking over, and you're the social media has really risen to a level, and you guys with the newsletter, you've got a newsletter. People could sign up for the newsletter and get news every month from the birthplace. And tell everybody about this. Roy is just pulling us into the 21st century at the birthplace. We now are online with a web store for the gift shop.
Yes, we finally have a web store. We were going to do it domestically for a few months, but last week we opened it internationally. It started off very good.
They got you ahead of schedule, didn't they? The international.
Yeah, it's got a lull.
Yeah.
But we knew it was a seed we would have to plant, and then we would have to water and fertilize it, and it may be a year before we get to harvest.
Yeah.
But it's there because people were constantly saying, I wish I could buy online because even if I'm flying back to Michigan, you know, I only have so much room in my suitcase, yada, yada. So I have big hopes for the online store.
And I got so excited when Roy, at one of the monthly meetings of the board, when Roy had some of the items. And see what I have here, Roy? This is kind of a takeoff of the bumper sticker that Roy and I grew up with. Yeah. That people had on their cars back in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
And we have it now. It's got Elvis birthplace, and it's just a little blue bumper sticker with the white drawing mm-hmm. Of the birthplace. And the other thing I think that's so cool that you have is just the little it's about the size of a couple of iPhones stacked together. The
about 6-inch house. Yes.
Yeah, a copy of the house. But it's almost like a folk art piece. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just got that feeling of the folk art to it.
And it's one of our top sellers because now people can literally take a piece of the birth house home with them, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, the English, especially in their small backyards and in the larger areas anyway, have fairy gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're perfect for a fairy garden or any garden.
Yeah. Well, we're going to, I'm going to plant mine outside. I think maybe I'll grow it into a full size birthplace. Well, Roy, it's been great having you here, and there's no one better to be taking care of the facility. Thank there. You. Rhonda keeps you in line. I know. So,
oh, yes. And I'm in my happy place. I couldn't be anywhere any happier. I do want to throw out, you know, we started our quarterly concerts this year.
That's right.
And our next one is May 4th with Nick Perkins. And if anybody's listening and they're in traveling distance, he's going to recreate a concert Elvis did in Lake Tahoe in the early 70s. He's going to recreate it song for song.
Okay.
And Nick does a good job.
And that's what date?
May 4th.
May the 4th be with you.
That, and we're playing on that.
There
thing.
You go.
May the 4th
yeah.
be with you.
Well, you know, Elvis.
And Nick is a Tupelo champion, so.
That's
yes.
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Elvis was trying to get a copy of Star Wars when he passed away, trying to get a copy to see the movie. And I know years later, just a few years ago, when Disney brought a bunch of their items from their archives to the exhibit hall there at Graceland, mm-hmm. Angie arranged a screening on the grounds of Graceland of Star Wars. So Star Wars could finally enter Elvis's world.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Cause awesome. he was trying to get a copy of the movie when he passed away. So the Star Wars thing runs through the Elvis story as well. Pretty much everything touches the Elvis story at one yeah, way
it
or
does.
Another.
Yep.
Well, Roy, thanks so much. I know you've probably got some people outside. You know, we say, donkey to you, for being a part of the Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking podcast, and to give the team there a big hello and howdy and thank you for all of us for the work that they do, because they're your front lines. They're out there every day with everybody. So
we are a team. I tell them, one monkey don't make a show. Take several to make a show.
And listen, if you've got a question, contact Roy. He's really active in social media at the birthplace. And like I said, if you've been to Graceland, there's a vibe there, but there's a slowed down home, small town America
family.
Feel in Tupelo and family.
Yeah,
Johnny's Drive-In, Christy and everybody at Johnny's. That's part of the story. Tupelo Hardware with the booths. That's part of the story. Milam School, Lawhorn School, and just see the city. Drive around Tupelo.
We have his library card, first library card, on display at the local library.
That's wow. right. Yeah, yeah. It's just. He was, you know, through town a lot. And as we talked about, that there may be a Cadillac out there right now driving around Crosstown. We need to go check on that, Roy. Thanks a lot for being a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Roy.
See you
Thank
guys.
You, buddy.
Bye.
Now, in November, come the longer evenings when folks drop in to play bridge or stop for a snack after the movies. So get the refrigerator stocked with Kraft's famous cheese food, Velveeta, to spread or slice for swell toasted sandwiches. Velveeta's a natural for late evening snacks, you know, because it's digestible as milk itself. These days, you really ought to be buying rich golden Velveeta in the 2-pound size, so you'll have plenty for snacks and also to melt for economical meatless main dishes. Remember, smooth melting Velveeta helps supply the protein you expect from a main dish, but the price is low. Tomorrow, get Kraft's famous Velveeta.
Tupelo Tom and Big Lou still talking, and I just want to say thank you for everybody out there that listens to the podcast. You know, sometimes, guys, I don't think we thank the fans, our friends who are
that we love
tuning in to listen to this, and
all over the world, actually.
That's true.
That's so cool.
You can look online. Alex was telling me that there's a place that he goes that will show him where people are listening to us from. Now, I don't know where this mystical place is that he goes, but
the dark web of the internet, actually. But we want to say hello to our friends in Ireland and Australia and Canada, Iceland,
wow.
the United Kingdom, the Netherlands. This is amazing.
Oh, wow.
Spain, Germany. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for listening.
And even Texas.
Yeah, it's a whole nother country.
Wow. It was, and I know my mom listens in Mississippi. So, boom.
Your mom had me put a widget on her phone so she can tap a button and just listen. So she did pay for dinner. That was nice.
Oh, she's unbelievable. I'm telling you. I guarantee you right now she's in the car going somewhere to buy something. So we are back, and this is a subject that I had been working on a while because, you know, I was enjoying the 30th anniversary of Turner Classic Movies, my old home that I worked for almost 20 years as head of production and worked on so many projects in movies. And it's because of TCM that I really became a part of the Elvis family through Graceland, because I worked with Elvis Presley Enterprises in 2000 on the recut of That's the Way It Is. And that's where they found out that Elvis had a guy on the inside at Warner Brothers with me, kind of representing the king and making sure that they treated him properly. I told you the story one time that there was a video of this was back when they were still releasing VHS. They had new packaging for Judy Garland movies, new packaging for Batman, and new packaging for Elvis movies. And they had all the artwork, and they sent me the Elvis artwork, and they said, look, we're so proud of this. And they had the VHS covers. They had Jailhouse Rock and the movies they own, and Elvis on Tour, and That's the Way It Is. And Elvis on Tour, they had a That's the Way It Is jumpsuit. And I said, guys, that jumpsuit's not from Elvis on Tour, that jumpsuit, because I think it was fringe, you know, and it was like, that's not proper. And they're like, oh, well, nobody's going to know, are they? They're not going to know. And I said, well, just the people that you want to buy it,
right?
The Elvis fans. I said, let me ask you a question. If you were selling Meet Me in St. Louis, Meet Me in St. Louis, the Judy Garland movie, and on the cover, you had a picture of Judy Garland, but she was wearing Dorothy's dress from Wizard of Oz. Is that a big deal? Because it's still Judy Garland. It's Judy that. Garland. Yeah, it's the wrong movie, but doesn't matter. Is that a big deal? And they were like, well, yeah, that's the wrong movie. And I go, well, I think you've just proven my point. And so from then on, for a number of years, anything they did Elvis related, they sent it to me for approval to make sure, is this the right artwork? You know, I'm a big, and Alex knows this from us talking about producing stuff. When I was an executive producer at TCM, I'm a big fanatic. I can look at a photo and tell you if it's been flipped because like somebody's face looks wrong or their hair's parted on the wrong side. I always can tell from the way the shirt buttons, a male's shirt buttons one way, a female shirt buttons the other way. And I can tell if an image has been flipped. So many times they would have Elvis playing left-handed guitar because they had flipped that's pretty easy to spot.
Right. Where,
you know, he looks like Paul McCartney playing, you know, left-handed. So, but anyway, so what I wanted to do is I started looking at Elvis movies, and there have been so many ways to talk about Elvis movies. You know, people will do a podcast and they'll say, we're going to watch another Elvis movie, and they're going to go in order and watch all the Elvis movies. And I'm like, people, they're coming in the Elvis world at all times. And so many cool Elvis movies to watch. Watch them in whatever order you want. I learned when I was also an entertainment reporter, I never liked to be a critic. I like to just inform, because one man's WW and the Dixie Dance Kings is the next man's Annie Hall, you know?
Right.
So it just depends on what you like as to if you like a movie or not. And my rule I always used to have was, listen, if you don't like Sylvester Stallone, don't go to a Sylvester Stallone movie, because there's nothing he can do that you're going to like. So, if you don't like him, don't go. So Elvis movies. I started looking at Elvis movies, and I realized when I was a kid growing up, I would always watch Elvis movies. And this is the way that so many, I know, at least the ETAs, that's how they discovered Elvis.
Yeah.
Was the movies, 3 years old, jumping up on the coffee table, Dean Z, and doing all the stuff. And so many now young people finding Elvis. And I always used to say that, you know, maybe in the 60s, perhaps not even maybe, the movies were a waste of his talent. But now we have 31 doorways to go through to see Elvis performing and moving. And except for Aloha and the 68 comeback special and some film out there, bootleg, there's not a lot of footage of him performing in the 70s, but we've got a lot of Elvis performances in movies. And I just wanted to talk about some of the people that were in Elvis movies that you might not realize, and some of the people that he worked with. Like one of the people that's always mentioned, the best director he ever worked with, Michael Curtiz, who directed King Creole. Well, that movie from 1958, you know, Michael Curtiz directed Casablanca.
Wow.
But he also directed The Adventures of Robin Hood and Captain Blood with Errol Flynn. Jeez. I mean, this was a big director working with Elvis. But also in that movie were people like Vic Morrow, who was a TV star in the 60s in combat, was the actor that was killed in the Twilight Zone helicopter tragedy. But also Carolyn Jones, who ended up being in the Addams Family. Dolores Hart, who became Mother Dolores, who was in a couple of movies with Elvis. Raymond Bailey, who was Mr. Drysdale from the Beverly Hillbillies, is in King Creole.
Oh, that's right.
And Walter Matthau.
Yes.
You know, looking a young Walter Matthau, looking stunningly like an old Walter Matthau.
I mean, he never changed, did he?
He never physically changed. He always looked exactly the same.
And, you know, he was so great in so many movies. Of course, Bad News Bears, one of my favorites.
Oh,
I thought
yeah.
he was perfect. There's nobody else could have played that role but him, really. And then there's a great movie a lot of people don't know about called Survivors. Robin Williams, Jerry Reed, and Walter Matthau. And it was one of the funniest movies where Jerry Reed has to explain to his wife as he's leaving, he's a hitman for the mob, but his wife doesn't know that. And she sits Jerry down and she goes, well, do you love her? He goes, love who, honey? He goes, the woman you see when you leave here. He goes, honey, remember Jimmy Hoffa? I'm the one that killed him. I'm not out there committing adultery. I'm committing murder. And she goes, oh, thank God. But, you know, I guess Matthau, one of the interesting things about him, he only would act when he needed more money to gamble, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently that was his big thing, you know, his gambling. I thought that was pretty
crazy.
Played
the horses. He played the horses.
Yep.
You know, I got to interview him a couple of times back in the 90s when I was doing film stuff. And to interview him with Jack Lemmon was... Wow. Amazing, because Walter would be talking, saying something, and Jack would, his eyes would be rolling, and he would be going, he's lying. That's not even true. That's not how we shot that. And you just let them go. They were best friends, and they were exactly the way they were on screen. Cause I think I said at one point, you guys either are acting now or you're not acting in the movie. I don't know which one.
Grumpy Old Man is so great.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got that. And from Grumpy Old Men, you've got Burgess Meredith, who was in Stay Away Joe.
Yep. And of course,
who played
Rocky.
Mickey. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. From your Rocky movie. Okay. Then you've got Charles Bronson, who was in Kid Galahad. Right. Everybody knows Charles Bronson. Kurt Russell, It Happened at the World's Fair, the little kid that kicks Elvis, who went on to play Elvis in the Elvis TV movie, directed by John Carpenter.
Yes.
Who Halloween. Dr. John Carpenter was Elvis's alias when he would stay in hotels sometimes along with John Burroughs.
I love when Kirk Douglas, when he did 3,000 Miles to Graceland.
Yep.
And basically played Elvis's illegitimate child, and as was Kevin Costner in that movie. And they recreated the scene of the little kid coming up and kicking Kirk Douglas in the shin like Kirk did with Elvis. That was pretty cool.
And I believe that was... Wyatt. I think that might have been Wyatt Russell, his son, who's in Monarch. Have you seen the Monarch series yet? The Godzilla series on Apple? You gotta see that if you're a Kurt Russell fan. Bill Bixby, big TV star in...
And the Hulk.
How many different series? My Favorite Martian, Courtship of Eddie's Father, The Magician, and The Hulk, Incredible Hulk. Bill Bixby in two Elvis movies, Clambake and Speedway. Vincent Price, the horror star from the Thriller video. I mean, there you go right there. But did so many classic horror movies. Is in The Trouble with Girls and How to Get Into It, along with Dabney Coleman.
Dabney Coleman.
Who is a great, who's the boss in 9 to 5.
He was the psychologist in Modern Problems, where he talked like this here. I'm not a freak. You know, he was so great. And North Dallas 40, he was in that.
That's right. I used to see him when I lived in L.A. He had a meal named after him. He had a dish on the menu at Dan Tana's restaurant, this little bitty Italian place. A lot of the iconic Hollywood producers and actors had a dish named after themselves on this menu because it was the dish they would order all the time. And there was one random night I was in there sitting at the bar talking to Michael, the Russian bartender, whose magic trick was he remembered everybody's drinks. Even if you hadn't been in 20 years, he knew what you drank. Dabney Coleman came in. There weren't very many people there. And he sat down next to me at the bar. And we started talking. And they just brought the his meal. He never ordered. They just brought the meal to him and sat it down. And I said, what did they do? That's incredible. He goes, well, you know, I got a dish named after me on the menu. And I said, oh, I guess that means you come here all the time. And he leaned over to me and he said, yeah, I really want something else now because I'm sick of it. But every time I walk in, they bring it to me and they're so proud they remembered. I don't have the heart to tell them, can I get something else? So there is a pressure.
A blessing you have and a curse.
It's cool to have a dish named after yourself, but I guess it's a curse if you and want you something love else.
Right.
So that's my Dabney Coleman story.
That's great.
Here's one that's interesting. You know Corbin Burnson?
Yes.
He was in L.A. Law, the blonde from L.A. Law. Blonde,
third baseman, you know, Major League.
There you go. He was one of the kids on the playground in Clambake.
Oh, really?
Did you know that? Yes.
No.
Yes. I'm going to assume a blonde kid on the playground. And everybody knows, well, not everybody, don't speak in absolutes, Ed Asner played the cop in Change of Habit, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I always envisioned him meeting Mary Tyler Moore on that movie and Mary Tyler Moore saying, hey, you'd be great as Lou Grant in my TV series.
Well, I mean, that had to have been something like that. You know, it just had to have been.
I'm thinking. And he was also a great bad guy in a John Wayne movie, but I digress.
Comancheros.
Ed Asner was also in Kid Galahad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what he was an assistant DA in Kid Galahad.
And by the way, it wasn't Comancheros, it was El Dorado, wasn't it?
It was El Dorado.
El Dorado, yeah.
Rod Boley Rod.
That's right.
Jimmy Kahn, baby.
Hey, Fancy Vest. Yeah.
Mississippi. Oh, I love that movie.
We can quote it real quick for the podcast. We can probably start at the beginning.
Probably so.
El Dorado. Doom's all right. Anyway.
Rod Boley Rod. Okay. Howard McNair, Floyd the Barber, appeared in 3 Elvis movies.
Oh, my gosh.
Fun in Acapulco. Blue Hawaii,
yeah,
and Follow That Dream. He played the banker in Follow That Dream.
Oh, you know, it's so funny because, you know, Floyd the Barber, one of the greatest characters of all time from the Andy Griffith Show. And I watched a documentary about that, and they said that the toughest thing about working with him is they could not keep a straight face. And they'd have to do take after take. They said he was by far the funniest character on that show.
And I was going to say, the characters that he plays in Fun in Acapulco and Blue Hawaii and Follow That Dream, whatever characters he played, I can guarantee you, they were kind of nervous. Yeah. Because he was always just a little, just a little nervous, Andy, just a little nervous. Yeah. So I was impressed by that. There's an actor named Jack Albertson who was in Chico and the Man and Willy Wonka. But he was also in Roustabout and Kissing Cousins.
Golly.
See?
The grandfather then, from Willy Wonka.
That's right. That's right. Remember the kid in the little kid in Fun in Acapulco that Elvis ends up, it's like they riding in the basket of the bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
They're singing, and he's this little Hispanic 7 or 8 year old kid. His name's Larry DeMasin. And I've interviewed him as an adult during Elvis Week at Graceland. And he told me one time, he says, you know, well, my niece, my brother's daughter is going into showbiz. And I said, oh, well, that's good. What's she going to do? And he said, well, she's just gotten a part. They're remaking True Grit with Jeff Bridges playing the John Wayne part. And my niece is going to play the Kim Darby character.
Oh my God.
The young girl. And God, his niece. So the little actor, the little guy from Fun in Acapulco, the little kid, his niece nowadays is Haley Steinfeld.
Jeez.
Who is like a big star. Like she's a pop singer and she's an actress and she's quite popular with the young people.
There you go.
But there's an Elvis connection. The guy that directed Girl Happy, Boris Segal, was a big time director, TV director, did a lot of TV movies, was killed in a helicopter accident, scouting locations. when you're around a helicopter, you don't want to back into that back blade.
Oh my gosh.
You know, you don't want, but his daughter, Boris Segal, who directed Girl Happy, his daughter is Katie Segal, who played Peg Bundy.
What?
And sang behind Bob Dylan.
And she was in that biker series.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sons of Anarchy.
There you go.
She was also a backup singer for Bette Midler.
Oh, wow.
You're right. That's right. She was.
Yeah, that is crazy.
Very good. This is the kind of stuff I do in my, you know, off time.
I mean, this is literally a big time Hollywood Walk of Fame of people.
Of Elvis. And
this, Elvis.
And it continues on.
Oh, good.
Because the director of Frankie and Johnny, one of my favorite, when I was a kid, this was probably my favorite Elvis movie when I was a kid, because it's very colorful and Ellie Mae's in it. And I had kind of a crush on Ellie Mae. And the director of Frankie and Johnny is Frederick DeCordova, who was Johnny Carson's producer, Freddie DeCordova.
Wow, that's your boy there,
who
man. Sat,
who was the guy that he would be like, Freddie, how much time do we have? Do I have time for this break? Okay, Freddie says, I got to go. That was Freddie DeCordova, boom, directed Elvis in Frankie and Johnny. Now, John Rich, who was the guy that directed Easy Come, Easy Go, John Rich was also a producer and produced a little TV series called All in the Family.
Oh, my gosh.
He was also a director, directed a little thing called The Dick Van Dyke Show. So
not a bad resume.
It's a pretty good resume. And like I said, there's another director named Norman Torog, who directed over 180 movies in his career. But in the course of Elvis's career, Elvis did 31 dramatic roles and 2 documentaries.
Correct.
Right? That's the numbers. Of those 31 movies, Norman Torog directed 9.
God,
wow.
And here we go. 1960, G.I. Blues. 61, Blue Hawaii. 62, Girls, Girls, Girls. 63, It Happened at the World's Fair. He took off 64. He came back in 65, did Tickle Me. 66, Spin Out. 67, Double Trouble. 68, Speedway. And 68, Live a Little, Love a Little. In which he, after that, retired from his career and taught film at USC Film School.
Wow.
And
what a career.
Elvis, and he also is the guy that directed most of the Martin and Lewis comedies. So he had a very, obviously a very quick shooting style and was able to let his stars be the star.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't let there was a phrase we used to have at Turner, that if you spent too much time lighting and too much time doing this or that, you're letting the art get in the way.
Right.
And it's like, if you allow a lighting person or a sound person to go until they're ready, they're never going to be ready.
Yeah.
You have to just say, okay, I don't care what the lights look like. We have to go now.
Yeah.
We now have to go. So, but then there's another actor named L.Q. Jones. And he's a character actor that was in a lot of Westerns. He was in The Wild Bunch. Obviously, I was going to say one of the people killed in The Wild Bunch, but pretty much everybody's killed in The Wild Bunch. So it's hard to narrow it down. He was in Love Me Tender, right, at the beginning of Elvis's career. He was then in Flaming Star with Barbara Eden, Jeannie, and Elvis. And then he was in Stay Away Joe. So he did 3 movies over the course of time. Mm. With Elvis from beginning almost to end. Now here's one of my favorites. The director of Flaming Star. Okay? So here's one that I think is very interesting. So Elvis comes back from the Army 1960. First movie back is G.I. Blues, right? Because he's been off in the Army. You got to do an Army movie.
Sure.
Next 2 movies he does, Flaming Star and Wild in the Country, more dramatic films, not a lot of music. Elvis playing a, you know, Native American in Flaming Star. Flaming Star, directed by Don Siegel, who directed Dirty Harry.
Oh, wow.
And in Don Siegel's book, Don Siegel talked about one of the most talented actors he ever worked with was Elvis. And Quentin Tarantino is a big Elvis fan. And is a big Don Siegel fan. And Quentin Tarantino talks about how he believes, unlike a lot of people who think King Creole is Elvis's best performance, Quentin Tarantino believes that Don Siegel and Elvis worked really well together. And it was always rumored that Elvis wanted to do harder edged movies. Wouldn't it have been interesting if Don Siegel could have talked Elvis into doing Dirty Harry?
Golly, that would have been cool. He might have been able to be himself a little bit more. And, you know, it's interesting. He had approached John Wayne about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And Duke just thought, maybe a little too much cussing for what my audience would like for me to do. And then, of course, the other legendary story about that is when Mel Brooks asked Duke to be in Blazing Saddles. And mm-hmm. he read the script. He goes, yeah, I probably can do that. And he goes, but I'll tell you this, I'll be the first one in line to watch it.
Yeah. And then not only was did he regret not doing Dirty Harry, if you look at the timeline in John Wayne's career, he did McHugh and Brannigan, which were these contemporary cop detective movies.
Yeah.
You know, John Wayne in a suit and tie. You know, it's just a little interesting to see John Wayne. I recently saw a photo of John Wayne on a movie set wearing his cowboy outfit, but he's got Ray-Ban sunglasses on. It's just like that. Just, you know, nobody ever wore sunglasses in cowboy movies, did they? Because they didn't have sunglasses. So. Anyway, so that's just a few of the things I found out about some Elvis movies and Elvis connections. And so I came up with an idea, gentlemen, and I'd like to share it with you and to share it with anybody who might be left out there listening. I want to create something called the Talkin' Elvis Movie Awards, the TEMU.
Okay.
Or TEMA. TEMA. That would be TEMA, wouldn't it? Yeah. That would be TEMA. And I want to come up with what we think are some of our favorite moments from Elvis movies.
I love it.
For these. So let's create, and we're going to do this, put this together, and keep tabs on us. We'll let you know when we do it. But let's vote on our favorite Elvis movie. We'll, you know, to me, the nominees are the nominees. It's, you know, you got 33 movies to choose from. But who's your favorite Elvis male co-star? Who's your favorite female co-star?
That's great.
Elvis, and you know, little things I found out too, I'm fascinated by. The reason Loving You is called Loving You is because they wanted another love title because Love Me Tender did so well. So that's why the second movie was Loving You, because they love that word love. So Elvis worked with so many amazing actors. So who's our favorite main actor that Elvis worked with and female actress? Also, what's our favorite performance by Elvis in a movie? All those musical dance numbers and singing and dancing. Who's our favorite? What's our favorite moment from an Elvis movie musically? And I love this one. What's our favorite cameo appearance? And it could be, oh, look, there's Jerry Schilling. Or, oh, look, there's George Klein in the background.
Or, look, there's Lee Majors.
Or, look, there's Lee Majors. And, yeah, as a waiter with a mustache. Just a lot of things. So we're going to work on that. We're going to kind of, you know, massage it and kind of talk about it. And there's so many people to pick from. You've got, you know, Nancy Sinatra. You got Anne Margaret. You got Barbara Stanwyck. You got all these people, Barbara Eden. So there's we could have a lot of fun with this, I think. And if you're a big movie buff like I am, it's always kind of fun to see how the movies of Elvis, just he worked with so many people that the intersection of them are just, it's quite fascinating to see who all he worked with. And I don't know if I told you, there was another time, speaking of TCM, we were doing a salute to boxing movies. And so we got together three boxing aficionados. We got together Burt Sugar, the boxing writer. We got Ray Boom Boom Mancini.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Angelo Dundee, who was Muhammad Ali's trainer.
Yeah.
And we went to Gleason's gym in Brooklyn. I think it's Brooklyn in New York. And we put him in the middle of the ring and we had them sitting talking about actors in boxing movies, like, you know, Robert De Niro and people like that and Raging Bull and stuff like that. Charles Bronson was in a bunch of fight movies. Clint Eastwood, you know, in Every Which Way But Loose. He's like a boxer fighter.
Wasn't James
guy.
Earl Jones in the Joe Louis movie, I think.
Is, and of course, Great White Hope.
Yeah.
And we had Elvis from Kid Galahad. So we gave him a telestrator like they have on sports, you know, thing where they could stop it and slow it down and draw circles around things. And over the course of this, they said one of the best actors as a boxer was Elvis because he didn't drop his shoulders.
Oh, wow.
They said he was, you know, in a movie, you drop your shoulder because you're not really following through. You're kind of telegraphing where you're coming and you're, you know, that he was one of the best ones. So there's a lot of things that we can find out from Elvis movies. It's not just sometimes just sitting back and
figure out how to kiss a girl.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that's some ideas I had, and we'll take that into committee and see how it works out, if we can get this bill into a law. What do you
think? And those of you listening, please email us. We've been getting some emails. Love hearing from you guys. Any ideas, anything you want to hear about on the show, or if you just want us to give a shout out to somebody, just email us at TupeloTomAndBigLouTalkin@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you and interact with you. And Tom and I are going to be at a lot of events coming up this year, as we were last year. We're going to be pulling out tables, sitting down and get some pictures, and maybe you can give us your autograph or something, but we're going to just talk to you and have some fun and
on a check.
And that's right. And get involved with us in emails. We'd love to hear from you.
So that's an idea we had about the movies of Elvis, and we'll continue working on that. The other thing we want to say is, before we wrap up the show, we want to thank everybody for coming out to the Nashville Elvis Festival. Jeff, Big Lou, and Alex, you were a big part of the Nashville Elvis Festival, and we want to say congratulations to Emilio Santoro, who is the Nashville champion, who will be competing in Memphis in August, and all of Nashville and everybody supports him in that. And I think it was a fun festival. Did you guys have a good time?
Oh, it was great. And Emilio's such a great guy. It was funny. He wished me a happy birthday, sent me a message, and at the very end, he goes, "And I'm Emilio Santoro, and I'm done talking." But I think he's got a great shot at the ultimate. He'll be such a great representative for our community. He'll be in Helen, Georgia for Jeff Lewis and Friends. Look that up at jefflewisandfriends.com. But no, he is a fantastic guy. Humble guy, unbelievably talented guy. He was on America's Got Talent as when they did the virtual thing. He was the Elvis that they used. And so I'm very proud of him and excited for him.
And I'm happy too, because he's such a good guy. He loves Elvis, and 21 years old. You know, that's what I love, just to represent the young Elvis generation. And thanks to everybody that performed. And thank Alex, you were a big part of that. My tribute to one of my favorite Elvis albums, Good Times, you and Bill Cherry.
Good Times.
Yeah.
That was great. It was a blast.
And my dream, I went back and found notes in my files, paper files, actually, by the way. I have a filing cabinet. Alex, next time you're in town, I'll have to show you my filing cabinet. You might not have ever seen one before. It's got files in it. I found up paperwork from 2020 where I had an idea, because I love the song Life, which is an Elvis. It's a gospel song, but it was on Love Letters for some reason. And I've always loved that song. And I had an idea to break it up into verses for each ETA to have a verse. And we were able to do that at the gospel show on Sunday during the Nashville Elvis Festival. So I was very happy about that. We got to, everybody got a verse to do it, and I finally got
that
to do
it. That was really cool.
And yeah. Infinity, what can you say about that band?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So I mean, never missed a note, just always on stage. And here's the thing, because when I'm up there being Charlie Hodge for the guys, and even during when I'm hosting during the contest, they are so with the performer as musicians. Even eye contact, you look at them. When you look at them, they're looking at you. Mm-hmm. They're not looking down. They're not looking at music. They're not looking at the floor. They're watching the performance and the performer. Yep. And that really plays a part in the kind of performance that a singer, that a headliner does. And we're going to be back in Nashville next year. You can check it out March 13th through the 16th. We're going to be a little earlier in the month, because we've got the big Cody Daneth cruise coming up the next weekend, I believe. So the 9th annual Nashville Elvis Festival, March 13th through the 16th, 2025, back at the factory at Franklin.
My birthday is the 16th.
Hey, there you go.
Oh, somebody's going to get
St.
cake.
Patrick's Day birthday almost.
Somebody's going to get cake and have to sing on their birthday.
That's
somebody
awesome.
Might be headlining on their birthday. Oh, my goodness. Well, well, well. I've got Sunday taken care of now. I just have to figure out what else to do. And as we record this, and you might be on the way to Louisiana, to the Louisiana Elvis Festival, Cody Daneth. Guys, any comments? The theater there is the one I remember from last year above every venue we played in. Just one of the coolest places that, that we played all year.
And this is one that Cody and I produced together, and we had had the idea of going into Louisiana for a long time. And this is our second one out there, I believe. Third one. Yes, it'll be our third one.
Yeah, because we were Baton Rouge the first
That's
year.
That's right. So we're very excited about that. Great lineup, as always. Of course, Alex and Cody and Bill and Dean and Ben and just a bunch of great talent going to be at that show.
Louisiana Elvis Festival in Alexandria, Louisiana. That's April 25th through the 27th with some amazing guys. Dean Z, Bill Cherry, David Lee, Brandon Bennett, Louisiana's own, Ben Thompson, Cody Danith, Victor Trevino Jr., and Alex Mitchell. Look at Alex going to be there,
yes,
along with Big Lou and myself, Tupelo Tom, will be there in Louisiana.
And you can go to etafestivals.com to get tickets and information.
We'll see you there. There's some cool things that'll be happening. Cody's put together, and Jeff, you guys all every year, these multiple festivals that Cote and you guys put together. There's always ideas for shows that I struggle every year with Nashville. I got one festival to fill up, and you guys are doing it monthly almost.
Well, luckily Elvis gave us so much material. It's just great to work with. You can kind of spin and redo and all that. It's fantastic.
Well, as somebody said to me one time, it's almost like every year is an anniversary of something.
Yes.
So this year and next year, we'll be taking a look and seeing what we can celebrate. Right. Anything else that we didn't cover, gentlemen, on this episode of the podcast? I guess not.
We got Burt Reynolds mentioned. We're good. I think we're covered.
The deafening silence told me either that I've lost you as listeners, or I guess we've covered it all.
Thank you to Roy from the birthplace.
Yes, that was so fantastic for him to do that, because again, there's so many new fans coming into the world that you got to see where it all started. It's just a big part of it. So thanks to Roy, and we got some cool special guests coming up in the future that we can't talk about because
I'm so excited.
We don't have them signed on the line that is dotted, but soon we will. And we can talk about those. But I guess that's it. I guess we're Big Lou. What do you think? I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou. And we're done talking.
Really? We done? Yeah. We done.
That's tight.